Welcome to the Wednesday edition of Life 2.0. I'm John St. Augustine. Usually I call this the Wednesday rant or Wednesday wisdom. I think they're both in here. I'll handle the rant part for the most part, because that's my part. And a little bit later in this episode, you're going to hear my conversation with the iconic Dr. Jane Goodall, and she'll handle the wisdom part, I'm here to tell you. This show has some specific ties to it, meaning, you know, I wanted to reach the broadest audience possible. Dr. Jane does not need my help. She travels 300 days a year doing consciousness and fundraising events. So she's raising people's consciousness and funds at the same time. What a concept. For her work for the Jane Goodall Institute. You'd have to be living on some other planet to not know that Jane Goodall, you know, is this towering figure when it comes to conservation and the humanities. And it all started because she went into the Tanzania jungle in 1960 and just didn't decide to come out for about 50 years. Over the past 45 years, she's also evolved herself from a steadfast scientist to a very passionate conservationist and an incredible humanitarian. So I wanted to reach the broadest audience possible, which means one of two things. Either I figure out a way to put up a paywall and get this worked into some mainstream sort of social media thing and all that stuff and charge a few bucks and then donate the money to the Goodall Institute. And it just got really difficult to figure that part out because, quite frankly, she's raising money and whatever I could put together, you know, might pay for, you know, her lunch somewhere at some point. So I'm just being realistic with it. So this is a free episode to the entire world, because I think that was the way to go. Dr. Jane's message should be heard by the entire world, and it has in many ways already, but I just wanted to support that. The second thing is this, I kept thinking, when am I going to air this show? This is a bucket list thing for Johnny. There's probably a dozen people, both living and deceased, that I would love to sit down with and line them all up at a bar and pour a few shots and have a great conversation. And Dr. Jane Goodall is on that list. And now I can kind of take her off that list. So there's the bucket list part. But today, the day that this show is airing, which is Wednesday, April 3rd, is Dr. Jane Goodall's 85th birthday. And I thought, well, there it is. There's the time to put the show up. So it's a freebie. This is courtesy of the people who are the Life 2.0 subscribers, of which I hope you will become one. I've talked about the PBS aspect to this. I've given up, frankly, trying to, you know, come up with sort of a system or solution to, you know, make this thing become a juggernaut, if you will, in means of the business model. Because there are a lot of people that have, you know, they charge a dollar and you get a million people to listen. I'm just not in that camp yet. So I am very thankful for the subscribers that plunk down $20 a month, which, you know, comes out to $5 a week. You know, that's just 66 cents a day. Actually, on 30 days, it's 66 cents a day. It's $19.80. But because of the subscribers, I'm able to throw these other ones out there. And then we have subscriber exclusive Saturday where we do interviews and things like that. So please, it's based on the PBS model. If you enjoy this type of programming, it should be on Channel 11 in Chicago. And if you think this kind of conversation with Dr. Jane Goodall and more that's coming down the road is worth $20 a month, $5 a week, 66 and a half cents a day, then please become a subscriber. It's easy to do when you're on the website. You just find one of the shows that says premium and you click subscribe to premium content now, and then you follow the prompts and next thing you know, we're in business. So thank you so much to the subscribers for creating the platform for me to be able to do these shows and then put them out to the rest of the world who will gobble them up, hopefully. This is April, and April used to be there. Is Earth Day. April 22nd is Earth Day. Then it became Earth Week. Now it's Earth Month. And of course, if we look at it in all honesty, every day is Earth Day. I hate to use the bumper sticker and the cliche, but that's exactly how it stacks up. And if you heard the show, if you're a subscriber and you heard the show I did on the last Saturday with Dr. William Fortune about the solar storms and all that goes along with it, and I rattled off that list of sun facts that we take for granted, that star that keeps us alive on this planet, keeps us heated, keeps all the life forms functioning and all this kind of stuff, you know, we just take it for granted that this is the way it is. I think so much of that applies to the environment we live in. We take it for granted because it's always there. Listen, if you've ever lived in a place where they had to shut the water off for whatever reason, a water main break or some contamination, and you've went to the faucet and opened it up and there was no water there, you start to freak out a little bit. A lot of people live that way every day. And there are more and more reasons for that around the world. And so every show that I do that has a central theme of the environment, of which we are inextricably connected, whether you like it or not, whether you believe it or not, isn't even relevant. What's relevant is we all live in a biosphere. And the ozone layer that protects this planet and holds everything together kind of thing, you know, everything that happens inside the biosphere affects everything else inside the biosphere. So for me, I try to push all the political garbage away because it doesn't matter how you voted or who you think is right or wrong and all that. It doesn't matter. We live in a biosphere where none of that matters. What does matter are the actual systems that keep us alive, the water, the air, the planet, the animals, all the pieces that go into that. So we're going to get to the interview in just a couple of seconds, but I wanted to give you what I think, for me at least, in broad terms, were the top 10 environmental issues. I'm not going to go into each one of them because we want to get on to the interview with Dr. Jane. But the first thing is public health. Bottom line is, if you live downstream in Flint, Michigan, you were up shit creek, even though you were downstream. When public health becomes an issue and there's a clear threat to it, there's a place in Willowbrook outside of Illinois here called Sterigenics. It's been in the news nationally. It's been in the news locally. And for a very, very long time, like 40 years, it's alleged, even though there's proof that they're doing it. So I got to use the word alleged for some reason, that their cancer rates around this place are double what they are anywhere else. And they, you know, the chemicals they've been putting in the water and the air and we're expecting people to police themselves. Any corporation that has a bottom line of profit are often going to say, if we cut a corner here or cut a corner there, no one's ever going to know until 40 years later. And the shit hits the fan. It's the ripple effect. Sometimes it takes time for those rings to come back and kick us in the ass. And so you read these stories, you see them, like the Flint thing, they're still having problems with their water. So when public health becomes an issue, it's everybody's problem, especially if you live there. Land management and urban sprawl. How many more strip malls do we need that are, you ever drive around in the cities where you live or the towns and you see them closing them down and they're opening another one 3 miles away as everything starts spreading out? The more building we have, the more stores we need, and all the construction goes along with it. And while this may not be the rainforest, which I'll get to in a second, every time that happens, an ecosystem is disturbed, either on a small scale. And we just don't see it because it's, you know, we don't pay attention to it. Next thing you know, there's a neighborhood, and next thing you know, there's schools. And these are not inherently bad things, but there has to be more visionary planning when it comes. And there's some of that is happening. You're starting to see these environmental easements and things. There's some things that are actually happening. So this isn't all gloom and doom. But when you start to realize how much concrete gets put down, and then like Hurricane Harvey comes along in 2017 and floods Houston, not a good idea. The less natural land, the more the environment actually takes a hit. Boy, is this one rub my rhubarb. Waste disposal. Listen, plastic bottles, first and foremost, when I was a kid, there was no such thing as bottled water unless you took an old Coke bottle, rinsed it out, and put water in from the garden hose. That was bottled water. And as soon as somebody figured out that we could sell humans what they already have, let's scare them. The water in your sink is not safe. In Flint, they're probably correct. But for the majority of people, and with public safety, you have to have safe drinking water. But as soon as they could convince you that, you know, this is better for you, there's electrolytes in there, or it's smart water. It isn't smart water. It's water, okay? And that we need more and more water. No one ever thought what the hell we're going to do with those plastic bottles. So what happens? They go in a landfill. They live there forever. They'll outlive every human being on the planet. And so waste disposal has become a huge issue. Trash really only ends up in one of two places. It's either landfills or in the environment. It's just laying around. And if you look at third world countries and you see the amount of garbage that's floating in the ocean, which is a whole nother show on itself, it's sad and it's disappointing. And we could do so much better. But there wasn't much vision to thought, what are we going to do with all these bottles? Just throw them out. I remember in the 70s, the commercial with the guy who was really Italian playing a Native American with the tear in his face saying, you know, what are we doing here? And there was a commonplace time where people just threw garbage out the window of their car. They dumped their ashtrays out when they were at the stoplight. People changed their habits a little bit, but now it's starting to come back again. Now you see plastic laying around all over the place, and it does not go away. It just doesn't. Overpopulation is a problem. We have more than 7 billion people on the planet. That number is expected to reach 9.7 billion by 2050 and 11.2 billion by 2100. I won't be here to see that. somebody else will have to deal with. But that's not the point. It may not sound like a bad thing. We live on a planet that can only support about 10 billion people. When you look at land mass and food production, all the resources, 10 billion is really pushing it. We're already at 7. So as the world population rises, the amount of resources available decreases. In fact, many experts say that we're already at an unsustainable level. We're using more than we can possibly ever put back. Loss of biodiversity is a huge thing. The variety of life in the world or a particular ecosystem is declining. Why? Humans. The levels of biodiversity across the board have significantly lowered to dangerous amounts. According to the World Wildlife Federation, biodiversity has declined 27% in the last 3 decades. Biodiversity within this biosphere is in critical condition due to urban sprawl, deforestation, and climate change. End of story. There's no arguing over that. These are the factors that put those things in place. Water is becoming more scarce and it's becoming dirtier. We have to try and keep up and get all these humans clean water. You know, many years ago, when I first got radio, 98, I got radio 97, probably 98, 99, somewhere in there, the vaunted Illinois Senator Paul Simon was a guest on my show quite a few times. He was the guy with the bow tie and the very deep baritone voice. Great guy. And he wrote a book called Tapped Out back then about the coming water crisis in the world. And that's 20 years ago. He passed away, I think, 2003, somewhere in there. And half of what he said would take 20 years had already happened out of that book. An estimated 780 million people have no access to clean water at all. They don't have a faucet. They don't even have bottled water. 780 million people have no access to clean water at all. The 2017 drought in California and the fact that Flint, Michigan hasn't had clean water in 4 years is the perfect example to show us that water scarcity and pollution isn't just a problem everywhere else. Eventually, it could be a problem in your own backyard. Deforestation. At least 15% of greenhouse gas emissions do not come from cars or factories. They come from deforestation, the lungs of the planet. Trees. By 2030, we may only have 10% of the rainforest left. The rest have been cut down for wood, wood pulp, or cleared for agricultural sites. You don't regrow rainforest. You don't, let's go plant a rainforest. It's not like they're in a bag of seeds somewhere, or like on Arbor Day where you go pick out a tree. This is the rainforest in the Amazon River basin where so much of what goes on in the rest of the world is affected by that place. Species lose their habitat, ecosystems die out, climate change continues. In addition, more than 70% of the plants and animal species that live on the forest could be wiped out, along with that area of rainforest. It's astonishing to me. We don't look very far down the line. The story of Teddy Roosevelt being in office in 1906 comes to mind when they wanted to do some strip mining in the Grand Canyon for uranium. And, you know, lobbying was already going on back then. There were lobbyists from the uranium industry lobbying Congress to allow this. So can you imagine? Because there's cash. There's uranium in there. Can you imagine if the Grand Canyon became a giant strip mine? I can't. Teddy Roosevelt stepped in, said, no thanks. We're going to leave this just the way that it is. If you mess it up, we can't fix it. And it has more value to the American people as it is than it does to the private companies that will make money off this. So looking down the road is not something that happens very often anymore. It's all about the dash and the cash. Due to the list of environmental issues that I've been talking about here for the last, 9 minutes, both ecosystems and species are affected by every other thing. It's like a big ripple effect, as I said. One out of every 10 plants and animal species is expected to go extinct by 2050. That's only 31 years from now. The endangered species list continues to grow as the ecosystems decrease. And with the rising temperatures of the Arctic, the sea ice melting, which eliminates the habitat of polar bears, the list of endangered species includes many other animals as well. And of course, the big one, climate change. Astonishing to me. You can go back to fifth grade, and I often do in many different ways, and it's all laid out. Or let me put it to you this way. As Chief Seattle said, if you shit in your own bed, one day you're going to suffocate in your own waste. We walk around, we can't even smell the stench because we're too much in it. And even though that 97 to 98% of scientists who study the climate agree there's greenhouse gas problems, both natural and those created by humans, are the main cause, and that global temperatures are climbing, ice caps are melting, and droughts, wildfires, super hurricanes tearing away across the landscape, while the truth is plain to see, the inaction of deniers in power positions only make matters worse. So that's why we got to get back to it. And if I were to say, you know, you're going to hear Dr. Jane Goodall talk about the greatest challenge to making all this change. She talks about apathy. I think that apathy and denial are Achilles' heel. It doesn't exist, and even if it did, I can't do anything about it. Well, you might as well just fold up the tent and effing go home. You know what I'm saying? So this whole show today is really a buildup on the front and the back side of this conversation I waited 30 years to have with Dr. Jane Goodall. And it comes on the forefront of an event I'm doing here shortly this month on April 15th with Bill Curtis. And we'll let this go, and then you'll hear the interview right on the other side.
The list of environmental challenges can be overwhelming, but there are solutions to the problems we face. I'm Bill Curtis.
I'm John St. Augustine. Bill and I look forward to seeing you at Earth Matters, a 90-minute multimedia event
on Monday, April 15th at Northeastern Illinois University in Chicago.
The doors open at 6:30 p.m. Admission is free, so spend the evening with us. Monday, April 15th, 6:30 p.m., NEIU Auditorium, 5500 North St. Louis Avenue in Chicago.
Because Earth matters.
I appreciate your time. I know you're very, very busy, and I'm just honored to spend a few minutes with you and help you any way that I can with the platform that I have to spread the message that's so very, very important. I hate to keep saying more important than ever, but it seems to be that way.
I know. Hmm. I know it does. Yeah.
So when you look back all the way starting when you were 26 years old, way back in 1960, and you've seen the arc of your work and how it's impacted the world, what are the indicators that you look for that we're having some progress as a species?
Well, there's definitely 100% greater awareness worldwide than there was when I began. But that's because when I began in 1960, we didn't face the problems that we face today. So the forests were not destroyed at that time. There's still the equatorial forest belt stretched across Africa. And, you know, so gradually people have become aware. And the biggest problem is that they become aware of the problems and then they feel helpless to do anything about them, so they do nothing and fall into apathy. That's the big danger.
It really is. I think that the alarm bell has been sounded so many times that people are afraid to answer it and they don't know how and what to do. And I've always been a proponent that you have to do something somewhere. You may not be able to go to, save the rainforest somewhere, but you can do something in your own backyard. And I think people need that reminder quite often. Do you find it, even though you travel the world now, and I don't know how you do it as much as you do it, the people that are responding, are you starting to see the apathy erode a little bit, or is it still an uphill battle?
Well, you know, most of my work when I'm traveling around, other than spreading awareness further, is with young people. And our Roots and Shoots program, which began in 91, is now in well over 50 countries. It's young people, kindergarten, university, and everything in between. And it's based on the fact that every individual makes a difference every single day. And those of us who are fortunate enough not to live in abject poverty, we can choose the kind of difference we're going to make. So, you know, the saying, think globally, act locally. I twist it around because if you think globally, you become helpless with horror of what's going on around the world. But if you act locally, okay, something I'm passionate about, I'm going to clear the beach of litter. I'm going to clean up a river. I'm going to raise money or volunteer at a shelter for dogs or cats. I'm going to raise money for hurricane victims far away. And you roll up your sleeves and you take action. And then you realize that all around the world there are other people like you who care about the same issues, who are also rolling up their sleeves and making a difference. And then you feel supported and strengthened by that feeling that you're not alone.
Yes, I've always said, and I've been doing radio 23, 24 years now, and the content has always lent itself to trying to make sense out of the senseless, because if you watch the news, none of this makes any sense. But when you pull away from the headlines and you get into the lifelines of people doing incredible work, that's where things could really change. Your work over the years almost has become all-encompassing. It started with the chimpanzees, of course, and shining a light on their plight and their existence. But now it's almost like what Chief Seattle said. Oh, actually, John Muir actually said it better, that if you tug on one thing in nature, you find that it's connected to everything else. Now it's very much all-encompassing. The chimpanzees are almost just a part of the puzzle, aren't they?
Oh, that's absolutely true. And, you know, the fact is that it was 1986 when I'd been studying the chimps since 1960. And we had a conference right here in Chicago, and it was the brainchild of Paul Heltney, who at that time was director of the Academy of Sciences. And we brought together the people who were studying chimps in six different parts of Africa by then. And we had a session on conservation, and it was utterly shocking. I mean, it was a shock for everyone, I think, to see the forest disappearing, the beginning of the bushmeat trade, the commercial hunting of animals for food, including chimps in some countries, shooting of mothers to steal babies for sale as pets or for the international animal trafficking. And we had another session on conditions in some captive situations, like the awful, awful treatment of chimpanzees and other animals in medical research and pharmaceutical research.
Mm-hmm.
So I went to the conference as a scientist. I had my PhD by then. I had a research station. The best days of my life out in the rainforest, where you learn about the interconnectedness of everything and the important role that even the tiniest species plays. And I left as an activist. So since then, I haven't been more than 3 weeks in any one place. And that's in twice a year, if I'm lucky.
Mm. So,
you know, so then I felt I had to go to Africa. I needed to learn firsthand more about the plight of the chimps. And learning about the plight of the chimps, I learned about the plight of so many of the people living in and around forest chimpanzee habitat. Flying over Gombe, which had been part of that great equatorial forest belt, and seeing below me a tiny island of forest surrounded by completely bare hills, and more people than the land could support, so overused farmland, infertile, steep slopes denuded of trees, terrible soil erosion, streams filtered up, people struggling to survive. And that's when it hit me. If we don't help the people, then there's no way we can even try to save forests and chimpanzees.
For 3 years, I've created and produced a radio program with Bill Curtis, who's a noted conservationist, does A&E, and he's got one of the best voices on radio, so we put him to work. And one of the things that really tried to focus on were the human aspects of this, because it seems that so much of what goes on with conservation, which is a very broad term, is dealing with the effects, not the root cause. And when you get down to the root cause, when it comes down to poaching, for example, there are people trying to simply make money. There's this whole black market thing. And rhinos are my pet animal. I can't even believe eradicate a species because of their horn, which does nothing. You might as well chew on a toenail because it has the same properties. And you see these people that are in difficult circumstances. And as the rise of ecotourism and eco-vacations come up and people make money, there are some changes that happen, but we have a long way to go. So when you're traveling around doing these fundraisers and you've seen the crowds come, what is it they, I guess what I'm trying to get at is it's one thing for Jane Goodall to go out and do all this great stuff, but do you think that if the people who are behind the bushmeat trade and the poaching trade, can they be converted into human beings that could make a positive difference as well? Do you think so?
Well, I don't know the people, the gang leaders, because it's now become, you know, it's big business. But what we can do, one, we can boost, we can help raise money so that the rangers on the ground are better equipped to deal with poachers. We can do education programs for the poachers, and yes, we can provide jobs through ecotourism. But the other thing is the demand. So our Roots and Shoots program, the young people, it's in the countries like China and Vietnam and Thailand, where the demand for these rhino horns and elephant tusks and pangolin scales is coming from. So we work on educating them and getting the word out there. Elephants are being killed. Rhinos are being killed. And people often, they think it all comes from animals who've died a natural death. There's a huge lack of understanding. So we work on that end, both ends.
It seems to be, and I'm 60. I feel young, but I'm not young anymore. I still consider myself part of the solution and far less the problem. But it seems to be that you're focusing on the youth, because they're really the ones that have to make the change. I've always thought that unless it's affects me, then it's somebody else's problem. So it's great to hear about rhinos and all that kind of stuff, and that's somebody that they would see that in a zoo, but actually doing something about it, that's out of most people's realm of possibility. But young people, what is the response you get when you do your Roots and Shoots program and when you give them this information? How do they respond?
Well, everywhere I've been in all these countries, by the way, we're very strong in China. The young people, once they understand the problem, we listen to them and empower them to act. They're out there making a difference. They're educating their parents and even their grandparents. And, so working with the young people, why? Because you hear, we haven't inherited this planet from our parents, we borrowed it from our children. But we haven't borrowed our children's future, we've stolen it. We're still stealing it. And it's time we get together in this little window of chance, little window of time that we have to make a difference. You've got to act together. And we've got to try and harm some of the, heal some of the harm we've inflicted before it's too late, and it will be too late.
The species loss is record in the history of just our short time as a species on this planet. And whenever I think of that, there's always the deniers of things, and people don't want to admit things. And I always, as you talk about apathy, I think denial follows right behind that. It's a evil twin, which is denial and apathy. And it's just easy to dismiss things, even though there's this unbelievable amount of scientific evidence that all things are connected, and what happens in one place eventually shows up somewhere else. They were monitoring what happened with the Fukushima reactor, and within a certain amount of time, it's already affecting fish that eventually make it to the, to our shores and all those type of things. And here in the United States, we like to argue about things but do very little as far as solutions. When you come to the United States and when you're doing your fundraisers and you're talking with people, do you see us, are we getting any better on this side of the water, or are we still kind of stuck in our old ways, do you think?
Well, some people are definitely changing, and they tell me so. I know, because the people who come to listen to the lecture, usually around 5,000, sometimes it's a lot more, and the response is making everything worthwhile. People are listening, people are crying, people come up and say, well, I'm going to do my bit now, thank you. Young people are saying, you've taught me that because you did it, I can do it too. And so they're newly inspired. We're planting trees and organic gardens and fighting the Monsantos. And just really more and more and more people making a difference. New York is about 150,000 active groups of Roots and Shoots, and that a group can be a whole school. And also, we've got all the people who went through Roots and Shoots in school, like Chinese people come up and say, of course we care about the environment. We were in Roots and Shoots in primary school. So it is a changing attitude, but whether it's changing quick enough, that's the burning question.
One of the most difficult things as a broadcaster, as a journalist, as someone who's written about this subject, and I've spoken about this for many years, is getting people to see that they are really connected to the planet. That if you don't think you're connected to the planet, just hold your breath for a few minutes and see what happens. We are inextricably we are just residents here. We're not the landlords. You know, we don't own this place. We're just passing through. And getting people off the headlines, as I said, and getting them out into the yard and out into the communities and planting trees and doing these things, I've seen a marked difference even since 1970 from the first Earth Day. But I've also seen a greater pushback than I ever thought was possible from politics, from politicians, from the government, and those type of things. However, saying that, I think there's a gap in there somewhere that then the responsibility comes to we the people, that we shouldn't be, if the Environmental Protection Agency is not doing their job or they've been cut back or whatever the latest and unfortunately greatest scandal is with the EPA, that's a call to action for us as residents of our country here in the United States to actually do something. You've had to put up a lot of political stuff. I'm not going to say the word that I would use for normal people, but you've had to put up with a lot of politics. And how have you worked your way through some really difficult times with that?
Well, what we try to do is say, you know, you can't actually fight those people in powerful positions. Certainly can't in China, you can't in Africa. And at least you're allowed to speak your mind here in the U.S., which is something. If we can't actually fight them, or we'll get, you know, disappeared or closed down or something, you have to work around them. And that's why working with the youth. So get enough young people, get to a tipping point. And when the dictators and the deniers finally fade and disappear, then the young people coming up will have the right ethic and the right attitude. But that's why I say, I don't know if we've got time.
You sound cautiously optimistic. You've used that word time 6 times in this conversation. Do you think that most people, is it because you travel so much that your urgency is there? Because most of us don't, we're all distracted with the news and TV and all that other stuff. Have your travels given you a different sense of urgency over the last few years?
A different sense of urgency, but also a different sense of hope. Because you said earlier, there's so many incredible people and amazing projects. And the trouble is the news is nearly always about doom and gloom. And doom and gloom turns people off. So, you know, I try and share the positive stories, the hopeful stories, the indomitable human spirit, the people who tackle what seems impossible and won't give up, the amazing brain that's beginning to come up with new solutions to let us live in greater harmony with the planet. And you know, the social media, which, yes, it can go wrong, we all know that, but it enables us to reach out in a way never possible before, to bring together people from around the world who care about a single issue and, you know, strengthen each other. So these are the things that give me hope and keep me going. The response to my talks in every country I've been in, you know, every single lecture is sold out. And people clearly want hope.
I've always said when you squeeze oranges, you get orange juice, and when you squeeze tomatoes, you get tomato juice, and when you squeeze humans, all kind of you know what comes out. And I think we are being squeezed as a species in ways we've never been squeezed before. So after all these years of work and traveling the world, what is the big takeaway? What is the big aha for you after all this time?
Well, I think it's very, very important to understand that although chimpanzees and other animals are way more intelligent than we used to think, chimpanzees share 98.6% of our DNA composition. They are our closest living relatives. They communicate in ways that we understand, kissing, embracing, holding hands, patting one another. They have a dark and brutal side, but also a loving, compassionate side. And so, yes, we're so like them, but we're different. I think the main difference is the explosive development of our intellect. Quite clearly, we're the most intellectual species that's ever walked on this planet. And yet, we're destroying our only home. You know, we sent a rocket to Mars. Little robots been taking photos. We've seen those photos. We don't want to go and live on Mars. And we only have planet Earth. So how come we're destroying it? And I think there's been a disconnect between our clever, clever brain and our human heart that's love and compassion. And we've fallen in the West anyway, and unfortunately it's spread around the world into a materialistic society. We've lost touch with nature, and always when there's an economic development like building a dam or a rapid transit or something like that, an environmentalist stand up and say, but you're going to destroy this unique piece of environment. But almost always, not always, but almost always, the developers that win and the environment is destroyed, that part of it.
Mm.
And so, you know, it's because we've sort of planned to worship money. We've lost touch with reality. And instead of thinking about future generations, we're doing things for us now or for the next political campaign or for the next shareholders meeting, instead of thinking about the consequences for the next generation, for the future, for the future of the planet. And we're forgetting that without the environment, that's the end of us. The forests give us clean air and water and absorb CO2, and they give out oxygen. The ocean's the same. We're polluting the ocean. We're destroying the forest. And the world's in a mess. But there is hope if we get together now for the reasons that I've already said. I won't give up. And luckily, there are many other people out there fighting for the same cause. There are hundreds and hundreds of small victories. And bringing it all together, then, you know, we have to make change. There's nothing else for it. We have to change.
The thing that you didn't hear in that interview, and her voice is fantastic to me. The thing you didn't hear in that interview was the last 6 minutes, 7 minutes, somewhere in there, we did it over. She had a bit of a coughing attack. Now, let me just tell you that I was supposed to be with her and meet her at her hotel downtown in Chicago, and there was a major technical snafu with email on their server and a bunch of other things, and I never got the email that said, come on down, I can meet you at such and such a time and such a place, and I'd be wonderful to see you and fantastic and great, and didn't get the email. And so had to do it on the phone, had some technical issues on my end, go figure. So when we got towards the end of the interview, she had a coughing attack. And once she got through all that and she kind of worked her way through it, I said, Dr. Jane, it's not. I'll edit through all that. She goes, let's have another go at it, shall we, John? Yes, ma'am, we'll do it again. And so that's what you heard the last 6 minutes or so, was a retake. I kept the first part of it just to, you know, I have a whole folder with stuff that's called fodder that I may or may not use at some point. So I chunked that out. And that last 6 minutes became as a result of, let's do it over again, shall we, John? That bit. Let's do that bit over, John. And she was in Chicago for this fundraiser. And as I mentioned earlier, on the front side of this, she does those 300 days a year. She went from a scientist to an activist in one fell swoop, as you heard her talk about in that interview. And I think in some way, shape, or form, anyone who has a life-changing, life-altering event, like Dr. Jane did, being at a coming out of the jungle, going to conference in Chicago, seeing the lay of the land and realizing she couldn't stay in the jungle anymore, she had to come out and be an activist. Whoever said, I don't know who it was, but whoever it was that said one person can't make a difference, did not know what they were talking about. Dr. Jane Goodall, the woman who redefined man, she changed our perception of primates and people and the connection between us. And she did it because that's her calling. That's what she's supposed to do. The leverage point to actually get this interview done has two pieces to it. The first piece is many years ago, I was going on 11, 12 years ago, I went to the mailbox one day. I was living in Michigan and this big parcels in my mailbox, this big package, like an envelope. I open it up and it's something called the Visionary Project out of the United Kingdom from a fellow named Will Murtha. And I don't know Will Murtha. I don't know anything about the Visionary Project. I've heard of the United Kingdom, so that I got. And I started reading this thing. It was a whole presentation about that there's this organization there that have deemed who the visionaries are in the world. They picked out people who were the Jane Goodalls of the world, making a serious, solid, constructive, concrete difference for the better. And I thought, well, that's very cool. I don't know what they're going to do with all this. And I started looking on the names of people in this and that, and many I recognized, Nelson Mandela and Jimmy Carter, Oprah Winfrey, and there was my name on the list with these people. And there was, and I thought, oh, I know what this is. This is one of those, we'll put you in the business reference library and you buy 100 copies, and you know, like I'd have to pay to be in this thing. And I was wrong. Apparently, I was chosen, not by anybody I knew, to be included with these incredible people who have been doing amazing work around the world. And it took me about a week to realize this wasn't a joke, that this wasn't something that was set up. Okay, who really sent me this? I've never once considered myself, and anybody listening to this that knew me in high school could vouch for that, but I've never once considered myself a visionary. Those are the Jane Goodalls and the Mother Teresa's and, you know, the Jacques Cousteau's. Those are not me. Eventually ended up, Dr. Jane Goodall and myself, in a book called 200 Visionaries, 100 Words. Out of that list of 500 people that were from the UK in the Visionary Project, Will Murtha wrote a book, and he asked 200 of us that were in the original lineup to write 100 words about what we thought the future would bring. So I was greatly honored to be in part of that book, and that was kind of the leverage point to say, hey, we're both in this book, and I've been waiting 30 years to have a short conversation with you. Is it possible? And that, along with a good friend, Dan Creeley, made this work. So sometimes it takes time for things to come around, and when you're ready for them, they tend to make their appearance. In that conversation with Dr. Jane that you just heard, she says there's an urgency because we're running out of time in many ways, but there's also hope in that. That is seeing the possibility buried in a very deep liability. So if I've done nothing else over the last 20, 25 years of my life, whether it's on stage speaking, as I will be on April 15th with Bill Curtis, you're all invited at Northeastern Illinois University at 6:30 p.m. for Earth Matters, the science and spirituality of ethics in action, because it takes both to make some positive change, or it's on this podcast, or it's been radio, or the book that I have coming out. All these things are about waking people up. And here's the deal. Life is set up in so many ways to put us to sleep. It just is. Eventually, your firewall says, I quit. I'm done. There's too much going on. I'm apathetic. It doesn't matter. And in that Human Math TED Talk that I put up on Facebook, and it's on YouTube as well, which really should be called MeTube, isn't it? It's not about YouTube, it's about me. How does this make me feel? It's MeTube, and it's about me. So it should be, hey, I should start MeTube, huh? There's the idea that'll put me up in retirement. There's YouTube, but there's MeTube. I don't know what exactly would be on there, but I should copyright the name. Anyway, I talk in there about the odds of being born are 1 in 400 trillion. That's a lot of friggin' zeros. And we are all allowed a bad day, a difficult time, the dark night of the soul. It's all part and parcel of being a human. But if you ever get to the point where that apathy is just turned into nothing but denial of your gifts and your talents and your abilities, then we need to have a serious talk. You need to remind yourself that you beat out 399 trillion others that didn't get here. There's a reason you're here. You can either take up space or create within the space you take up. It's a choice. And part of that is finding out what your calling is and what you're called to do and taking action towards that, come what may, that you realize that the day you were born is really important, but what's even more important is the day you figure out why. Thanks for listening. Until next time, safe travels. Adios.
As the old saying goes, the numbers never lie. And when it comes to the environment, the numbers are shocking. As with any research that has to do with numbers, there is always a plus or minus either way that determines an accurate reading of a problem. When it comes to the inhabitants of the Earth, the non-human population, the numbers are more about the minus than the plus. The World Wildlife Fund estimates that we have lost 50% of the creatures that swim, crawl, walk, and fly in just the
past 40 years. The correct word here is not lost because they will not be found. The more accurate term is eradicate, which means to put an end to or destroy completely. With elephants and rhinos teetering on extinction within the next decade, it's a wake-up call. If half of the animals at the Brookfield Zoo died next week, it would make headlines. And all this eradication comes from human activity. I'm Bill Curtis, and Earth Matters.